Spirit Radio Podcasts.
Now, the Turkish offensive in northeastern Syria this month has brought into fresh focus the plight of ordinary civilians, including Christians caught in the crossfire. And a local church leader there has been very direct in his criticism of the role of Western governments in this ongoing war, saying their actions have been counterproductive and motivated by self-interest. Meanwhile, the charity Aid to the Church in Need has warned that the countdown to Christianity's disappearance in parts of the Middle East is ticking ever louder. Last week they launched their new report, Persecuted and Forgotten 2019, at the UK Houses of Parliament. On the line now to tell us more, we have John Pontifex, Head of Press and Information at Aid to the Church in Need. You're very welcome to the show, John.
Hello.
So first of all, John, your report, on your website, you had a report on the situation in northern Syria, and it focused on two cities, Hasake and Kamishli, if I've pronounced them correctly. Can you tell us about these two cities and how the most recent conflict has affected people there?
Well, yes, we've had reports from Bishop Hindo, who is the Emeritus Archbishop of Hasake and Nubisi. And he was really giving his reflections on the way in which the incursion from Turkey into northeast Syria has massively affected the local community. Bearing in mind, of course, that that particular community had suffered hugely, not just because of the incursions from Daesh, ISIS, but the wider disruption and instability in that region. But what he was saying, that in over the past few days and weeks, many of the communities, the Christian communities in particular, had moved from the border towns, those towns closest to Turkey. They'd moved to Hasake really to find safety and some degree of security. And of course, all this is to do with the way in which concerns are that Daesh fighters and their families are on the run following a strike on the Çakırın prison in Kamishli. And of course, this is really the worst possible nightmare for the local community, bearing in mind how the Kurdish forces were instrumental in rounding up the Daesh and other extremist forces. The very fact now that there's real concerns that those forces have not actually succeeded ultimately in securing an end to the Daesh threat is something that will cause enormous worry, enormous concern. And the bishop was warning, as indeed have other bishops, not least Archbishop Bashar Wada from Erbil. The two bishops have warned that the impact of any form of regrouping of Daesh could indeed cause a massive reaction among what remains of the Christian communities, both in Syria and in Iraq, with a very, very real possibility that a further exodus will take place.
Wow, that's very concerning. The bishop was also very outspoken about the motivations of foreign powers in their actions in Syria, wasn't he?
He was indeed, and he considers that in essence the local communities are being the sacrificial lamb for their own end. And he describes the United States, Italy, France, the UK as well as Germany should, as he puts it, offer their own mea culpa because of all that they've done, in his view, with regard to intervening in Syria and indeed the wider area. So he feels that they've been sacrificed for these greater international ends.
Wow, that's a great concern. Now, John, I know that Aid to the Church in Need has been doing great work. You mentioned Iraq there, and you've been doing great work in northern Iraq, helping the rebuilding of Christian towns destroyed by ISIS. Now, we talked to a young lady from one of those towns, Karakosh, just a couple of weeks ago. She walked into our studio during our pledge drive, and we had the pleasure of talking to her and interviewing her. This, I'm just going to play for you and for our listeners, one of the things that she said. Her name is Rand Sabe.
In the day that we ran away from there and from Mosul itself, about 136,000 people ran away, all Christian people ran away from their homes. But now only half of them are back in their homes because the other decided not to come back and they just left the country. Well, even now, people, they don't feel like they really belong to this earth because we face too many dangerous and crisis there, especially for the Christian people. So everyone like thinking like, what is our fault to be like Christian, Iraqi Christian, mm-hmm. and being killed like that?
So that was around, she actually fled from Karakash in 2014 and has since returned, but saying that many of her, you know, that community have not returned because of their fear, you know, that they are treated as if they don't belong in Iraq. John, is this typical of the feeling among Iraqi Christians?
Yes, I think there is great division of thinking within the hearts and minds of the Christian community in Iraq. Of course, they feel they belong to the land. They have belonged to that land since time immemorial. Their presence in Nineveh dates back thousands of years to before the time that they even adopted Christianity, which of course is in the earliest years of the faith, going back to the first century AD. But the reality is, of course, that the ongoing threat, the instability, the violence, the very real sense in which they don't feel that they have the rights in order to play their part in society, mean that in real terms, they've given up hope in some cases, and they just want out. And I think if we were in their shoes, if we were living their lives, if we were in that situation of deep instability, we would be feeling the same, this great sort of sense of uncertainty, and on the one hand, wanting to stay, but on the other hand, feeling, well, what is there to stay for? And of course, what we sadly have to bear in mind is that while there has been a tremendous amount of work being carried out to enable the Christians to go back to Nineveh following the removal of Daesh from that region, the fact remains that it's still unstable, and we know that the Shabak Shia forces have made incursions into that area, that there are militia, and that that whole area is on a fault line between the Sunni Shia groupings, and Christians are caught in the middle. So inevitably, that plus the lack of work opportunities, the lack of education, the very slow progress being made to build up the infrastructure, be it schools, be it roads, be it hospitals, be it other forms of healthcare, mean that people just feel very, very vulnerable. And that's why Aid to the Church in Need is doing everything it can to build up the Christian presence, not just in terms of providing pastoral help, but really rebuilding these homes that have been damaged and destroyed, helping with other projects, supporting those who are providing work opportunities, rebuilding orphanages, convents and other things, because all these elements are needed if people are going to really feel that they, as we might say, belong to that area. Because if we don't succeed soon, the reality is that people will begin to lose heart, lose faith, and indeed make that huge decision to leave.
Yeah. John, you've published this new report, Persecuted and Forgotten 2019, which, you know, warns of this countdown to Christianity's disappearance in parts of the Middle East. What action are you looking for, sort of, governments and things like that to do? You know, what contribution can they make to stop or reverse this trend?
Well, there's a lot that can be done, even though you might feel that with Brexit, with financial instability, and with other challenges, many and various, in our own countries, the reality is that working together with other international power brokers, leading powers in the international community, there's an awful lot that can be done. And we would particularly highlight the need to invest in the rebuilding of communities that have traditionally had a great presence of minority groups, not just Christians, I hasten to add, but Yazidis, Mandeans, other minorities, because the overwhelming sense we have as we make our journeys to the to such countries as Iraq is that if we see Christianity disappear, and that is sadly a very real possibility, if we see it disappear, it will sound the death knell for the survival of plurality. So if we lose that plurality, there inevitably will be a build-up of tension and suspicion, and more the countries will become identifiable by their religious majority grouping, which will in turn make it difficult for other groups to feel a part of that. So it behoves all the international communities to work together to build up those communities, and that really must involve at a practical level. As a charity, we've done a great deal of work, but it's just too big a job for us to do by ourselves. We, as a charity, have helped with the rebuilding of 2,000 homes in Karakosh, one of the major towns in the Nineveh Plains. But what we know is that that is just at the tip of the iceberg. If you look at the houses as a whole, if you look at the roads, if you look at the hospitals, if you look at the schools, let alone the security presence, the police force, and other forms of security presence, all these things, the Iraqi authorities needn't feel they have to carry out by themselves. We can surely lend support as and where the Iraqi authorities feel it's possible for us to do so, working with the United Nations, working with other peace brokers, because we are all implicated in this outcome.
Yes, indeed, John. And it's such an important report. It's called Persecuted and Forgotten 2019. Can it be purchased, or people go to the website acnuk.org?
Yes, they can certainly go to the website. It is free for anyone to get. They can simply go to the website, as you say, www.acnuk.org, and they can thereby make an application to receive their copy, or indeed read it online. There are parts of it that are available online, and you can see the various points that we're making. One of them, of course, being that it's great that the international community has made steps to help Christians and other minorities, but we need to turn statements of intent into policies of action.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed. John Pontifex, Head of Press and Information at Aid to the Church in Need. Thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you very much, Steve.
Thanks, John. Today, many young people are playing multiple sports. This is a good thing because it gives them an opportunity to try different disciplines and allows them to develop a wider set of skills and physical strengths. But the risk is that they might also overtrain, giving rise to burnout and injury, potentially long-term injury. Now, our next guest has won an award for a new sports app, or you could say a new player welfare app, that addresses this issue, allowing sports coaches to share and monitor the training activities of their players across different sports. It's called Surpassport, and in studio now to tell us more, we have its inventor, its developer, Adrian Geisel, winner of the Best New Business Startup Award from South Dublin County. You're very welcome to the show, Adrian. How are you?
Morning.
Thanks very much for coming in. So maybe can you tell us a little bit about yourself? Are you a full-time inventor or app developer or full-time coach?
No, certainly not the latter. The latter is for fun. I'm a dad, I'm a scientist, but what I've been doing for the last 30 years is writing software and usually solving problems that other people find challenging, shall we say.
In this case, so you have kids playing sports and you got an idea.
Indeed. I've two kids. My elder, she's in college. She would not have been a strong ladies footballer, but she was part of an amazing team, and the team spirit and the coaching around that was really exemplary. My son, on the other hand, is very active. He obviously plays in club, he plays hurling, but he also plays for school. And so he's got an interesting mix.
So, and he likes different sports. He probably likes the social side of it. And, you know, I have a son sort of involved in different sports, and he gets asked to play. Oh, you can play for our team. We're short of players or whatever. And so he's putting his hand up all over the place because he loves sport and he loves the social side of it as well. But he can end up playing an awful lot of sport. And the thing with this is that, this app is about trying to manage that, isn't it?
It's about the information that a coach has and doesn't have. So in that example that you just put out there, my son at the moment, he's playing up in age as well, because he's able to and because they need the numbers. So the challenge is that there are times when it's fine to do that and there's times when it becomes difficult from a workload point of view. The main thing is that a lot of people don't know, and it's the information around that's the issue. Not so much the level of sport that a kid can do is up to the kid itself, right? And it's not necessarily where they're what they want to do, but it's about their biology and about their physiology, so it's about where they are in terms of development. But either way, the science behind this is robust and goes back to the mid-50s, where it's a consistency of workload, a consistency of sport, and that is the key.
So you did a fair bit of research when you were developing this this app. What research did you look at?
Again, I was very interested in what was good for my son or not. The anecdotes were out there to say, yeah, you should have no more than 4 competitive sessions a week. Even the Irish Times supplement today has an entry in there about how much sport is right and they're trying to prescribe it. But it's not prescriptive, it's individual. It has to be individual. I went back, I have a science background, and in trying to answer the question for my own family, and my own son, I went back to literature and found some very interesting work, and it's heavily referenced, and it's all about consistency of workload and how that relates into the risks of injury.
Mm-hmm. So, I'm kind of thinking back to when I was a teenager, and I played rugby in school, and I was certainly getting roped in by friends to play with the local soccer club. And I'm kind of thinking back then, you know, if I had got to play more and more for that club, I don't think I would have told my rugby coach. But I think the culture has changed, hasn't it? That coaches are now willing to put player welfare first and to encourage or facilitate kids to play multiple sports.
Absolutely, and I'm a firm believer that anybody who's involved in coaching underage sport or sport at an underage level very much has the interests of the kids at heart, right? They obviously themselves have a passion for the game. They have skills they want to impart. They want to bring this forward, not just in terms of the success for that generation, but also making sure that it follows through into when these kids become adult themselves. With that in mind, the organisation of sport has also become more serious, more professional, more intense. But if you marry the two together, the issue around this is that there's a lot of good training that's coming down from the national governing bodies. So I'm an accredited coach through the GA system. And they talk about making sure that we coach in a child-oriented way and that we're aware of the child's circumstances. The difficulty about that is that each kid has their own unique mix of what they're doing and when they're doing it and how long they've been doing it, and it changes on a continuous basis. And that's a very difficult problem for anybody to keep in their head or different. Mm-hmm. And
So how does the app work? So this is an app that people have, and there's information about a player, and it's shared by coaches from different teams. Is that how it works?
Okay, so it's an athlete-centric or a child-centered team management platform. Mm-hmm. From the coach perspective, it's a team management platform. But the information that they have there, it connects back around each individual player and by extension involving their parents or the player themselves. When that player's second team also uses the app, then first of all, the parents get a single heads up view of what's coming up. But the coaches on both teams can then see what else those kids are involved in. Mm-hmm. And if you take it as between 15 and 25 kids on an average squad, that multiplies up very quickly.
That's very useful. Yeah, it becomes very useful. And so what has the take-up been? Like, I think you started it in the GA world, and it's gone now into basketball and other areas.
Yeah, so like everything else, I'd like it to be faster, but the reaction has been exceptionally good so far. So we launched it to my own team back in June of last year, and use that as a working pilot. The reaction, I believe, is quite good. I'm not championing it in my own club because that's different reasons. But we went sort of to a much broader audience from late last year, and very quickly we had a conversation with Basketball Ireland, and they loved what we were doing.
I think it's very interesting because basketball in Ireland for many kids is their second sport. Isn't that right? There, you know, they might be playing soccer or GA or rugby, and they play basketball, and it's in fact, you know, gives a lot of complementary skills. But it means that, you know, so many basketball players are playing other things as well.
Absolutely. So there's two things going on there. One is that, as you say, like the act of catching a ball over your head is kind of a great skill to have, be it as a soccer goalie or obviously as a Gaelic football player, and there's boys and girls. So there's that recognition. The second thing as well, though, is that basketball tends to, or people who play basketball tend to play longer, as in into older life, so it becomes more of a social sport as well, whereas that isn't always the case for the
heavier contact sports. Yes. Yeah, so that's great. And so where do you go from here? Like, you've won an award, so it's clearly been recognised as, you know, as a great business idea, among other things, you know, as well as being you know, a useful sports app. So it is growing, and so you're encouraging other sports, other teams to get involved, so a team can take on Sir Passport and start to use it straight away?
Absolutely. So through the website, a team can sign up. That's straightforward. I'm more than happy to be involved in that, as much or as little as we need to be. We can have a team up and running in 5 or 10 minutes.
Really?
It's quick and easy. Where are we going from here? Okay, so we've one national governing body who've really like what we're doing, and we've an active conversation with a handful of others. And I'm interested in having that conversation at national level, but it has to work at club level. And what seems to be happening as well, and I'm not quite ready to go full public on this as a project yet, but there's a community who've come together around sport, and they've been trying to do this for about 2 years down in Munster. And what they recognise is that it's the same kids playing everywhere, and the parents are frazzled and they're running around crazy and mad. But there's some really excellent coaches on the ground, and they're very much into the modern and evidence-driven means of coaching. And so Passport is a mechanism for them to actually achieve what they want to do, which is to bring their community together around sport.
That's brilliant. So if somebody's listening and is interested in checking out the app, you can go to sirpassport.com. Is that right, Adrian?
That's it.
Yeah, so it's absolutely brilliant, and I really hope it goes from strength to strength. Yeah. Adrian Geisel from Nason, County Kildare, and developer of Sir Passport, and the winner of the Best New Business Startup Award at South Dublin, in South Dublin County. Thank you so much for talking to us this morning.
Thank you, Steve.
The closing date for the 2019 Team Hope Christmas Shoebox Appeal is Friday, the 8th of November 2019. So really, now is the time during midterm break to be filling those shoeboxes and getting them to one of the many drop-off points around the country. In studio now to tell us more about what to put in that shoebox, we have Jonathan Douglas, who is Senior Officer for the Christmas Shoebox Appeal in Team Hope. You're very welcome to the show, Jonathan. How are you?
Very good. Thanks, Steve. Thanks, Jonathan.
So first of all, Jonathan, It's busy time now. What's the atmosphere like in Team Hope headquarters?
pretty busy, yeah. Especially it was in the lead up to half term. Most schools were trying to get in their shoeboxes or get more leaflets. So next week will certainly be the busy week, I'd say, because schools will be getting their filled shoeboxes back in, and we'll be collecting those boxes.
Fantastic. So it really is like, it's a huge operation. I wrote it down somewhere. 259,079 boxes last year.
That's right, yes.
Amazing. So really, it's a huge operation and a great operation. It's really, really well run, and it just gets so much participation from different groups and organisations around the country. So Closing date is Friday the 8th of November, so that's less than 2 weeks away. So now is the time, particularly for people on midterm, to be filling their shoeboxes. So you're here today, really, Jonathan, to tell us all about what to put in that shoebox. So you have a 4W guideline. Tell us about that.
Yes, there are the 4 W's. So the 4 W's stand for wash, write, wear, and wow. So in each shoebox, we'd encourage you to put in something to wash with, like maybe a toothbrush or a toothpaste, or maybe a hairbrush. Something to write with, so you maybe some markers or some crayons or a colouring book. Something to wear, like socks or maybe some gloves or a hat. And then something to wow, like maybe a pair of sunglasses or a skipping rope or maybe a cuddly toy. And those would be perfect.
Yeah, so it's great. It's a very simple acronym, and you can really pack a lot into a shoebox.
Okay.
One question is, if I haven't bought any shoes lately, where do I get a shoebox?
Well, that's a great question. We have what's called these flat pack shoeboxes now, and they're available with different retail partners across the country, primarily in Deals.
Brilliant.
I was just in the Deals in Bray this morning, and I bought my own. I got you can get 3 for a £5, and they have the Team Hope logo on them. And these boxes are the ideal size. They're the perfect size because you can fit the right amount into a box. When you buy them, a little donation even goes towards Team Hope, and you get more for your money. You get 3 for a £5. So they're a great option.
Great. Okay. So you don't have to use them, but you can use them.
You don't have to use them.
They're available there.
But they're available. Yeah.
But if you're a big buyer of shoes, that's fine. Just use one of your
just
own
use
shoe
your
boxes.
Own, wrap your shoe box. Yeah.
And these boxes are going to Eastern Europe and to Africa. Isn't that right?
That's right, yes.
And they need to be in early, like we think of Christmas, but you've got a massive logistical operation ahead, and hence the 8th of November deadline for people to get those in. Now, I've been having a look at the website. It's excellent. You know, the information on it is very clear, and there really are a lot of drop-off points. Mm. So that's where people go if they're you know, many people are involved in a school, or a workplace. But if you've got nothing, you know, within your, you know, immediate circle, you can still get involved by just looking up for a drop-off point. Is that right, Jonathan?
Yes, there's over 400 drop-off points across the country, and they're all available on our website, www.teamhope.ie, in the Christmas shoebox appeal section. As I said earlier, so Deals are involved, so you can also drop your shoeboxes back to Deals. The same goes for Toymaster and AXA. And this drop-off points are especially if you have, say, any boxes under the 50 number. So if you've made any more than 50, like typically schools would tend to do maybe more than 50, so they would arrange with our local coordinator to pick up those boxes. But if you just made a few, which is fantastic, you can drop them back to Deals. So say you could even buy your box in Deals, fill your box in Deals, and then drop your box back to Deals. But you can also do it for, there's 400 the drop-off points, and they're all on our website.
Now, one of the things you're saying about what to put in it, you're kind of saying things like socks, underwear, hats, scarf, and gloves. Now, we shouldn't assume that, you know, just because somebody, you know, a box might go to Africa, that something like a hat wouldn't go in useful. Would I be right in saying that?
So you might wonder, like, oh, do I put in a hat? Do I put in some warm clothes? The answer is actually yes. Do put in those hats and scarves, because Africa is a very hot continent, but at the same time it gets very cold at night. So please do put those things in. And the only thing that we'd encourage not for Africa is chocolate.
Chocolate, because it will melt
naturally.
And in general, actually, there is a list as well as what things to put in. You have a list of what things not to put in, isn't that right?
That's right. Also on the website, but also in the leaflet. So in each box that you make, you're going to put in part of the leaflet that kind of separates into a little envelope where you put your €4 in. But the leaflet also explains what not to put in a box. So we would kind of encourage you not to put in things like any liquids, kind of like no shampoo, no bubbles, because, you know, they tend to freeze when they go over and then they break and destroy the box. So no liquids like that, no sharp objects, no food, no books with words, and especially no scary items. And it's like, you know, it's Halloween time right now, so we'd encourage no kind of scary items in there. Nothing war related, and no toy snakes as well, because kids in Africa are encouraged to be afraid of snakes.
Okay.
So nothing like that as well.
Yeah. So it's brilliant, and it's just such an amazing initiative. Are there, if people want to help out in other ways, is it still possible to volunteer with Team Hope?
Yes, absolutely. November is the time when the shoeboxes are checked in a local warehouse to make sure that the items are suitable and ready. So if you are interested in volunteering there, just contact the Team Hope office and you can reach us on 01-294-0222. And yeah, we'd be happy to link you up with your local coordinator no matter Brilliant. Where you are in Ireland.
Brilliant. Well, it is an antidote to all the take for children at this time of year with trick-or-treating and things like that, focus on how much sweets am I going to get. This is an opportunity to get your children involved during midterm with a simple project that is all to do with giving. And Jonathan, thank you so much for coming in and giving us such a clear explanation of how to fill these boxes and how to get them to a collection point. Jonathan Douglas, who is a senior officer for the Christmas Shoebox Appeal. Thank you so much for coming in and talking to us this morning. Thanks. And if you want to find out more, it's teamhope.ie. The closing date for the appeal is the 8th of November, and you can look up teamhope.ie to read how to fill in a box and find a drop-off point near you.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie. Yeah.